Texas goes it alone, naturally, as the first state to officially snub healthcare reform.
And how long will shareholders stay on hold for Research in Motion to turn things around? Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. It's the Marketplace Midday Update for Tuesday, July 10th. Along with those items, we'll talk about why more Americans, particularly apparently in Indianapolis, are riding the bus.
Also, we've got an interview with Melinda Gates, the chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She's going to be talking to us about some of the new initiatives from the foundation, but also why there aren't more women in high-ranking positions in business. It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
So a fun day is getting underway at this hour for Research in Motion. RIM makes the BlackBerry, right? And 2 weeks ago, the company turned in a $200 million quarterly loss, and they said the new BlackBerry operating system will be delayed until after the holidays. Not a good thing. Today, in Waterloo, Ontario, which is their headquarters, RIM has to put on a brave face for shareholders at its annual meeting. Might be a little tricky since the share price is down 95% from its peak. Eric Jackson is with us from nearby Toronto. He's a managing member of Iron Fire Capital. Hello, Eric.
Hi.
So give me the very latest here. Just how dire are things for Research in Motion right now?
Well, I think they are pretty bleak. The question is, are they going to be able to see their vision out as an independent company? I think the next 6 months are going to determine whether they're going to be able to continue to go it alone or whether they're going to have to be sold to someone else to kind of carry forward that vision.
Sounds like you have a little bit of faith. Make the case to me. Why is this more than just a death watch at this point?
Well, 2 years ago, they bought a company called QNX, which is basically the operating system that they are now working on for what they're calling BB10, which is this latest and greatest software update. The software has already been embedded in a ton of smart devices all around the world, including cars. So that's the bull case, is that RIM can potentially, if they do this right, get into all of these other devices, which are massive and are only going to become more important as we get more and more internet connectivity.
RIM is one of Canada's best-known companies. How do Canadians feel about what's going on?
Even though you still see a lot more BlackBerries on the street in Canada than you do in the U.S., when you go into some cell phone store, the clerks will actually say, well, you shouldn't buy BlackBerries because they're not going to be around in a year or two. So it has changed quite a bit. And now it's gotten to the point where most Canadians are, wringing their hands and kind of wondering aloud, why is it that we cannot seem to kind of persist, when we have successful technology companies?
Well, Eric Jackson, managing member at Iron Fire Capital, good to talk with you. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Well, checking the markets at this hour, Asian markets ended the day down. European stock markets are having an up day, and here in the States, things are more or less flat. The European markets closed higher, no doubt, after finance ministers there announced a new deal that's going to send the first batch of bailout money to banks in Spain.
In London, the just-resigned CEO of Barclays Bank, Bob Diamond, will give up an expected bonus of about $30 million, but don't feel too bad for him. He still walks away with about $3 million in pay and pension payouts. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York says it had questions about Barclays' handling of LIBOR as early as 2008. More than a dozen banks are still under scrutiny for their possible roles in manipulating that interest rate.
And just a little while ago, lawmakers in Russia voted to join the World Trade Organization. This is something they've been negotiating over for 18 years. Joining that the WTO means Russia needs to cut tariffs and open itself up to further foreign investment. And also, we get a new report today from the anti-corruption watchdog Transparency International. And it says, basically, that big business is not doing enough to crack down on corruption. The report slams the usual suspects, companies from China and Russia, but it's not happy about some American corporations either. For more on that, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Transparency, as the name suggests, believes that openness is the first step towards cleaning up business and eliminating corruption. The watchdog has put 105 of the world's biggest corporations to the test and then ranked them as to how open they are about their own affairs. An oil company came top, Statoil of Norway. The Bank of China came bottom. No surprise there. In another index last year, Chinese companies were ranked among the most likely to offer a bribe. But, says Transparency's Karen Egger, at least China's trying to improve.
China has recently amended its criminal code to introduce foreign bribery as an offense, and, you know, we welcome that.
Much of the global drive against corruption has been powered by U.S. governments, but Transparency says the performance of American corporations in this index is generally not good. The U.S. was dragged down by its financial sector. Goldman Sachs and Bank of America were among the low-scoring companies. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A human rights group supportive of the opposition in Syria says more than 17,000 people have been killed in the 16-month uprising against the Syrian government. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting this morning that the Syrian regime is getting some help in the form of diesel from Venezuela. Keith Johnson co-wrote the journal story, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what exactly does your reporting tell you that Venezuela is doing for Syria right now?
Well, right now they're sort of lending them a lifeline by sending them refined products. In this case, they've been sending them an ultra-low sulfur diesel that the Syrians need to keep their regime going. And since Syria is sort of a pariah state, most of the Europeans won't do business with them, Venezuela stepped into the breach.
And when you say keep their regime going, I mean, how important is diesel in terms of doing that?
Well, from what we understand, it's actually doubly important. On the one hand, just for the general economic activity, of course, they need diesel for the tractors, farm machinery, things like that. But in particular, the T-72 tanks that the Assad regime uses, they do run on this diesel as well. And so some of the Syrian opposition movement leaders have told us that this diesel is vital to keep Assad's military forces in the field.
And what's the U.S. saying about this?
Well, the U.S. is kind of caught because unlike the sanctions on Iran, which are very far-ranging and quite powerful, the current law in terms of sanctions on doing business with Syria, it affects U.S. companies and U.S. nationals. You know, it doesn't say anything about the Venezuelan oil company doing business with these guys. And there's some movement afoot in Congress to try to patch over those problems, and we may see some legislative action to try to come up with a tougher sanctions regime for Syria.
Keith Johnson is a staff reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, a handful of states have talked about it, but the Lone Star is the lone state so far to officially opt out of critical parts of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, healthcare reform. Texas Governor Rick Perry has sent his letter to the U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services declaring Texas's intentions. They're the first, but they certainly might not be the last. To get clear on the details of opting out, we've got Dr. Mark McClellan. He is director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. Hello.
Jeff, good to talk with you.
Very specifically, what does Texas say it is not going to do?
It says it is not going to do the Medicaid expansions that are offered under the Affordable Care Act, and it also says that it's not going to set up a state insurance exchange. This is the state support for making insurance coverage available under the law.
The Supreme Court, right, laid the groundwork, the roadmap, I guess you might say, for how Texas can do this, right?
It gave the states more options. Under the law as it was originally passed, the states had a take-it-or-leave-it offer. They could either take the expanded Medicaid program, which would include about 13 million estimated new people covered around the country, or they could take nothing in Medicaid at all. Judge Roberts said that that amounted to a gun to the head of the states, and he said that the federal government could only offer expansions of Medicaid, not make it conditional on participating in the entire baseline program. And according to Governor Perry, they want to exercise that option of just staying where they are in terms of Medicaid coverage, not expanding it out further.
So they can decline the expansion, and that allows them also then to opt out of the exchanges.
Well, the exchanges is a little bit less clear. As the law is written, there's a provision for a federal fallback where the federal government would run an exchange for Texans if the state government doesn't set it up.
Uh-huh.
And the federal government has been working on setting that up, but there still are a lot of unresolved details there as well. A lot of this law is very much a work in progress, and a lot of the further direction to the law are going to depend not only on the Supreme Court decision, Jeff, but also on what happens in the election in November.
In terms of sheer dollars, what is a state like Texas giving up when it declines this additional Medicaid money?
Well, it's giving up a lot of additional federal funding. I think the state concern was also that it would require some state funding on top of that. And as you may have noticed, there was some reaction to Governor Perry's announcement in Texas from the Hospital Association, from some of the other provider groups, saying basically that, look, this is a lot of money that could be going towards helping people who would otherwise be uninsured and otherwise help us with uncompensated care. So still a lot to be resolved, despite the Supreme Court decision and despite Governor Perry's recent announcement.
Dr. Mark McClellan is a former administrator of the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and currently director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Great to talk with you too, Jeff.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
The proportion of foreign aid that goes to family planning in developing countries has fallen dramatically in recent years, as more and more money is being spent on other health needs. Well, tomorrow in London, there's going to be a major conference that aims to bring the focus back to family planning.
It's being organized by the British government and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. For today's Midday Extra, we are pleased to bring you an extended interview with Melinda Gates herself. She's with us from Seattle. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, your latest effort is aimed at providing contraception to women around the world. Why that issue?
Well, we know today that 200 million women around the world would like to have access to contraceptives and don't. And we know that it's life transforming for them and their families if they can plan the timing and the spacing of the births of their children. And so I think we should give them the simple tools that we have in places like the United States or the UK. The time is now.
Do you have any problem with the fact that contraception is still pretty controversial? Even in this country, we just had a big brouhaha over whether insurers should provide contraception for people. Do you have any problems with religious organizations in some countries for that?
Well, you know, I think we've made contraceptives really controversial, and we shouldn't. And what that's meant for women all over the world is that we've taken it off the global health agenda. And so now we've got to put it back on the global health agenda, because most Americans, 99% of women say they use in the U.S. contraceptives. And so we're talking about giving these tools to women all over the world. And when I travel in places like Africa, you would be amazed at what women know about contraceptives and say, why is it I could get them at my healthcare facility just a few months ago, and now I go in for that Depo-Provera shot and I can't get it any longer. I don't know when I can get another one, and I'm not ready to have another child. I have this young one that I can't even feed today. So we need to not make it controversial so we do the right thing for women all over the world.
What about the issue of education? I've seen some of the studies that that show that the birth rate in many places is tied directly to the amount of years of education that a woman has had.
Absolutely. And so we do need to educate women around the globe. We also need to educate them about contraceptives so that they know what's available in their community and they can then decide what they want to do. They need to have options so they can decide what makes sense for them. But we know just a little bit of education for a woman, she wants to bring down her birth rate, because what she knows is that if she can time those births, she can save her own life, and then she has a chance of feeding and educating her children, which puts her whole family on a new trajectory for their life.
How do you decide to get involved in an issue like that? There are so many things that you could obviously do to help, and you do many of them, but how do you pick them? How do you pick the issues?
Well, you know, I've been traveling now for over a decade for the foundation, places like Bangladesh, India. I go to Africa many times a year. And as I would go out and talk with women about their needs and their desires for their families, you know, I go out to talk to them initially about vaccines and other life-saving treatments. But what kept coming back over and over again from women was, why can't I have a contraceptive? I want to have fewer children, and yet I don't have a tool available. I used to be able to have one, and now I don't. And why is that in my country? And so this has just been resonating for us for quite some time. Bill and I actually started the foundation working both on vaccines and on contraceptives. We got away from contraceptives for a little while, and now we've realized it's really got to be back on the agenda. So I'm very enthused to make sure that we can give women this access.
Do you feel some responsibility as one of the most powerful women in the world to focus on issues that perhaps men don't think as much about?
I do, because I think the right thing to do in terms of giving families options, you have to put the tool in the hands of a woman. And I think unless a woman comes out and says, this is really, really important and we have to do it from the bottom up, we have to let women plan their families, I do think it takes a woman to stand up and say, this is important. Otherwise, we've seen what's happened the last 20 years. The tools haven't gotten out there. And so it's time.
Why do you think that in 2012 there is still such a lack of women in high-ranking positions, especially in the world of business?
I think that's a complicated issue, and I think it's different depending on where you go, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in the United States. But what I would encourage women to do is to use their voice. And when they see an issue, stand up and speak about it. When they see another woman they can mentor or sponsor into a role, I think that's really important for women to do. And I think you see women doing that more. And I think the more we see that, I think you'll start to get this positive momentum of more women actually climbing into some of those positions. And we are seeing some progress, but certainly not enough.
Did you personally ever struggle with a work-life balance or feel that you couldn't advance in a way that a man could?
I think all women struggle in the United States if they're have children and they're working. I'm sure all women struggle with that work-life balance, and certainly I do. The foundation has unique challenges because I travel around the globe, and obviously if you go to a place like Africa or Bangladesh, you don't just drop in for a couple of days. But the nice thing is that this work allows me to do both, and I enjoy it so much. And what's really made me passionate are the women I meet on the ground and realizing that I can give voice to them, to the issues that they really struggle with. I mean, you want to talk about a real life struggle? Can you feed your children? Can you educate your children? And I'm so passionate about giving voice to them that it's worth working on.
What do you think that organizations like your foundation can do that governments can't or that individuals or businesses cannot?
Well, I think all a foundation can do is really be a catalytic wedge. We can shine light on the issues where you can have really incredible impact with foreign aid and with dollars. We can take some of the innovation and the risk out of the equation so we can try new innovative tools, whether it's a vaccine, whether it's a new contraceptive tool for a woman. We can start to pilot those and scale those up, but ultimately it takes governments to scale these up on a widespread basis. But we can bring all of those partners together around a global issue and coalesce the field to move a goal forward.
It's such a unique thing to do, to go around the world and help people in this way in so many different capacities. I wonder, is there something that you can remember back to when someone that you had did not know came in and helped you in a big way?
Well, I've had many people in my life, but yes, I mean, I think one of the greatest opportunities in the United States is an incredible education. And so I had many teachers along the way, but one in particular, a math and computer science teacher who in high school said to me, you can be good in math. You are good in math. I'm going to get you a computer. She set me on the way of giving me confidence and knowing that a girl could be great in science and math. And that was important later for what I did in college and now what I do at the foundation.
You mentioned that you've been to a lot of countries. What country do you think needs the most help right now that you've been to?
I would say that there are a whole host of African nations that could use help. What I'm seeing, though, is a lot of hope on the ground in Africa because of foreign assistance. I'm seeing an emerging middle class in Africa. But I think unless you get these tools in the hands of women, you're not going to be able to bring down the birth rate. And so I think that becomes very difficult then for a country to manage when you get an enormous population, such as a country like Nigeria. But I'm also seeing huge progress in countries like Ethiopia, who have a large population, but they're doing all the right things in health for their country.
Who would you say is the most inspiring person that you've ever met?
I would certainly say Nelson Mandela. What he did in South Africa in such an incredible way to help the country move forward, not only when you watch his speeches, but when you meet him in person, his unbelievable wisdom with how he moved forward in very tricky issues, that's something that resonates with Bill and me around the foundation. And it took a lot of courage.
Melinda Gates is the co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great. Thank you, Jeremy.
The American Public Transportation Association says over the past year, more of us have been taking the bus. One big jump in that number came in Indianapolis. We gave reporter Sean Beter a microphone and a bus pass, and we sent him to downtown Indy to find out what the deal is.
Even though gas prices have been falling, their upward trend over the past few years was top of mind among bus riders recently in downtown Indianapolis.
The gas prices.
Gas prices.
Gas prices are just too high.
Dwayne Thompson Jr. drives for a living. He delivers packages for FedEx. But after 11 years behind the wheel of his own car, he started riding Indigo public transit.
I figure, well, I might as well just let the car sit. Sit at home and I can save all this money.
Bus ridership in Indianapolis has spiked about 12% this year. Indigo President Michael Terry says a lot of that growth is coming from people like Dwayne Thompson ditching their cars.
There's a groundswell, if you will, of individuals who are seeking alternatives to driving. And keep in mind, this isn't a competition. This isn't about one or the other.
Terry says rather than replacing their cars, many Indigo riders are complementing their car travel with public transit, choosing whatever option works best for them on a given day. It's a trend catching on across the country. In fact, public transit this year had its biggest first quarter jump since 1980. There's a problem, though. Ridership is growing, but money for public transit is running short. Nationwide, more than half of public transit agencies have had to either cut services or raise fares to make ends meet. Mike Malanafy is president of the American Public Transportation Association. He says future funding is uncertain.
The federal fund, which often is the capital money to replace and add more buses and trains to our systems, has been a challenge.
In Indianapolis, rising costs and cuts in government support have left the agency with a budget gap of more than $6 million. Indigo's Michael Terry.
Our biggest concern right now is replacement of capital. And we have an aging bus fleet, and we're using our federal money for operating, and we should be using it for capital.
That means no new buses, at least for the time being. Even with lower gas prices, Indigo doesn't expect significant falloff in ridership. June's figures were nearly as high as January's. In Indianapolis, I'm Sean Beter for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, everybody loves stupid criminals. Here's one we could put in the stupid cyber criminals category. It's the 21st century now. So these would-be data thieves in the Netherlands loaded up USB thumb drives with viruses to steal data from a chemical company called DSM. All right, that sounds reasonable if you're a hacker. Then they thought, we'll drop them all around the DSM parking lot. That was their technique for disseminating the virus, for getting it inside. Of course, that plan works if an employee just picks up the USB stick and pops it into his office computer. It does not work so well if an employee has a shred of common sense, which they did, and just takes it straight to the IT department. So nice try.
Very smart. Well, you know, there's a new study from UCLA. It's detailed in the Boston Globe today. It finds that our lives are getting overwhelmed by clutter. I don't know what you're looking at in the studio there. It's certainly pretty cluttered in my studio here in New York.
It's very feng shui here.
Well, the study says that, you know, you can tell if you're one of these people that's susceptible to clutter. If your refrigerator door is littered with magnets and calendars, then the rest of your home is likely to be in a chaotic state as well.
That sounds like you're just susceptible to children, perhaps.
That could be, too. And actually, this study talks about all the toys that people buy for their kids that the kids never use, and they end up just sort of piling up in closets. But even people who put a lot of money into outdoor decor actually, according to this study, rarely went into their own backyard. So they're not getting out enough. They're staying in their cluttered homes. And most amazing to me, 3 out of 4 garages are now too full of stuff to hold cars.
Now, it was always important to me to get my car into my garage, but we had a garage sale before I moved out to L.A. here, and it was insane. Insane the amount of stuff that I got rid of. So I believe it. Finally, here's a guy making a rather serious move to clear out some clutter from his life. 7,000 video games sold on eBay by one man in France for $1.2 million. And this guy's collection included every game ever made for most Nintendo, Sega, and NEC systems, if anybody even remembers NEC systems, and a whole lot else beside. So the guy who's buying this, apparently, guy or woman, I don't know, for $1.2 million, is in Canada. So adding a lot of clutter to their life, apparently.
You know, the one game that I used to love to play that I have not been able to find for a long time is Adventure Island, which was a Nintendo game, old school Nintendo, way back in the day. It was a great game. I don't know where it is, but this guy obviously has it if he's got every game that's ever been made. So
I remember getting lost and very frustrated in Mega Man. I think that scared me off of video games for good. Anyway, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.